This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 57. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What'd you think about the updated intro there, Mike?
Oh, I loved that you ran it by me first.
I just feel like our audience has been expanding from developers. You know, there's a lot of folks who email or even post on iTunes, and they're kind of like, I'm not a developer, but I still like this. So
yeah,
we want to broaden our audience a bit.
I did notice that at the Business of Software Conference, because I ran into a lot of people who listened to our podcast there, which was kind of surprising. But just the number of people who weren't just developers who listened to it, I found that interesting as well.
Well, hey, we have some very special guests with us today. It is Justin Vincent and Jason Roberts from the TechZing podcast. You guys want to say hello?
Hey, guys.
So
nice to be here.
I imagine we have a lot of overlap, so a lot of people will probably already know you guys. This is going to be a roundtable, TechZing for the Rest of Us, I think is what we'll call this episode. The theme for today's show is how to launch something on the side. And we wanted to pick something, kind of a topic to talk around that all of us have experienced and that we could all kind of lend some insight into.
I think that you're about to do some updates with you and Mike.
That's right. Mike, what's new with you?
Oh, with AutoShark? Oh, well, I spent some time working on the ability to support more than just a single customer. That's coming along pretty well. There's a few things that I'm looking at that have some... Have you ever written code and you made a huge number of updates and you're pretty sure that it works, but you're afraid that there's something in there that you screwed up? That's kind of where I'm at right now. So I have to go back through and make sure that everything is actually working the way I want it to, because I'd rather find the bug than have a customer find it.
Files, doesn't that mean it works?
Oh, of course. You know, and everything on the internet is true. So
yeah. Wait, what about unit tests? Don't you have a suite, or do you have a suite of unit tests, I should ask?
I do, but not for UI. So this is all UI-related stuff.
Got it. It makes it tough. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. I have three quick updates. A couple shout-outs, actually. One is many thanks to Dan and Ian of the Lifestyle Business Podcast. That's actually one of my other favorite podcasts. Very cool. We're going to have Dan on in a few weeks, and they just, you know, continue to kind of be fans of Startups for the Rest of Us and talk about us on their show. And I've seen some folks come to the website from theirs, and they've blogged about us and all that stuff. So it's just really cool to kind of be in that community. And there's another podcast I wanted to mention called Coder Talk, started just maybe about a month or two ago, Joey Benninghove and a couple other developers. And they mentioned us, talked about the podcast, and talked about my book. And then I picked it up in a Google alert and wound up going on the show, I think episode 8 or 9. So anyways, if you haven't checked that out and you're a coder, it's heavily technical. And if you're into that stuff, it's cool. It's a bunch of coders sitting around chatting about stuff. And then the last one is we now have 62 ratings in iTunes, which I'm stoked about. It seems to be growing every week. And I really like the most recent review is by Strict9. I like the second paragraph. He says, if you're just starting out in the world of micropreneurs and single founder startups, head over to the podcast website and start at episode 1. It's a crash course in almost every issue you will encounter along the way. And what I liked about it, A, it's a nice compliment, but B, I went back and tried to listen to our early episodes, and they're so painful. Like, we are so stiff, and I don't know. And I've actually had feedback from other folks that it was that way as well, and we really kind of came into our own in the teens, I think. So anyways, I thought that was funny.
As Rob said earlier, the topic is how to launch something on the side. So we're going to go through a list of about 5, I guess, high-level questions. And the first one is what to build. And Justin, I'll ask you specifically, because you had this idea a while back, and then you changed, you know, you went out, you implemented it, or you started implementing it, and then you ended up changing the name of it, and you finally ended up with Plugio. And I'm curious to know how you decided to actually go ahead and build that.
And maybe to start with, you could just kind of give a brief overview of what Plugio is and for new listeners.
Sure. Well, Plugio is basically a Twitter social dashboard. So it's actually a social media dashboard where you can automate tweets and you can also add in RSS feeds, get content. It makes it very easy to share content, very easy to grow your following. So where Plugio came from was because myself and Jason started a podcast, like you guys have started a podcast. And we're on episode 156 now, which is about to release. And when we started 2 years ago, we were wondering how we could promote it. And the very first thing we spoke about on the podcast, actually, on episode one, was Twitter. And I just got interested in Twitter and thought Twitter would be an interesting promotional tool. So when I kind of explored how to make the most out of Twitter, the first thing I thought was, well, what I need to do is put good content on Twitter so that if people are following me, they'll get great tech content. And then hopefully when I post a podcast, they'll go and listen to it. So that was my idea. And I found that it was a pain to do that because I had to go around the net and find great content and then copy and paste the links, store them in a text file, and post them out a few times a day because I didn't want to flood my followers. So I thought, wouldn't it be cool if I just had this tool where I could plug in RSS feeds, Hacker News namely is what I was thinking about, and just manually click a little button on any stories that I like. I can kind of go and view the story and then click a button, and then it will put it to a schedule queue and roll those tweets out during the day. So basically, that's what I built, and I just built it for myself in the first place. We didn't really know at that stage that we were a bootstrapping show, or that we're not specifically a bootstrapping show, but we just talk about it a lot. That kind of evolved over the first few episodes, and then TweetMiner was what it was called originally, and I just started building it, and all the decisions for it and everything about it have been on the air over the last 156 episodes, and myself and Jason have been brainstorming it as it's gone along. Now, it's not hugely successful, but it's earning around $3,000 a month and has about 225 customers.
What made you decide to change the name?
Originally, it was called TweetMiner, and the problem with that is it's just completely Twitter related. And as time went by, I realized that this opportunity was a bigger opportunity than just a Twitter opportunity. It was a social media opportunity. And you can, with Plugio, you can post to Facebook, you can post to any social network. So I needed to remove that name of Twitter in there, the tweet reference, but also TweetMiner. The reason why I called it TweetMiner was because originally it was to mine the content, but somehow TweetMiner just seems a little, I don't know, a little spammy or something. So that's why I changed the name. And what I mean with Plugio is it's just you're plugged into every social network. That's why I changed it.
Got it. So the advice we hear a lot is things like scratch your own itch, and that's essentially what you did here, right? You built a tool that you needed to use. Now, I've seen the scratch your own itch thing bail a lot. I actually, in general, think it's not very good advice. I think a lot of developers try to build tools for developers, and the market's just oversaturated, and developers don't tend to want to pay, and they want to build it for themselves and stuff. But in this case, it has worked out reasonably well.
I wouldn't do the same again. I wouldn't. I think that I only did it because of my naivety of being a bootstrapper at that time, an entrepreneur at that time.
Got it.
If I had the opportunity now, I would do some basically anthropological research around a specific niche and find a group of people who had a problem, and I would build something to solve their problem.
Got
because it. It's just easier to get money that way. It's been really difficult to grow the revenue of Plugio because of the space it's in. It's got so much competition. All the competition's free. No one wants to spend any money in that space.
So you'd go probably more customer development style then?
I would. That's what I would recommend. If I was going to start again, I'd try and find, as I said, some problem that needs to be solved that people are willing to pay for.
How about you, Jason? You've built many apps. You can give people a brief overview of any of them if you want, or the things you're working on now. But I'm curious how you've, because I don't know that you've ever talked about how you've come up with your ideas.
First of all, I'd like to say this is the longest I've been silent on a podcast.
I could hear you almost jumping in and then like holding your breath.
I did. During your intro, there's about three times where like, I'm like, all right, give him space to talk. So one thing I just want to add to what Justin said, I think it's possible to scratch your own itch or find something that you're really interested in, but also do some anthropological research and find a niche. I mean, I think it can be dangerous to build a product in an area that you just don't care about, because as soon as the going gets rough, it's easy to just bail. It's like, you know, I don't even care about this anyway. This is stupid, you know? But if it's something you fundamentally are excited about and understand, it can give you a real advantage. But I think what happens with kind of what you guys are saying is that a lot of developers, they just want to get developing. So they just start, they code like the first or second idea that comes to their head, which is the same first idea that comes to everybody, which is why it's so oversaturated. But I do agree that selling to developers is a dangerous proposition because they don't want to pay for much. So just on those topics. So one of my products that I built that might be relevant to the discussion was Prezo, which was a web-based version of PowerPoint. And I wrote an article on the web that went pretty big, and a lot of people seem to have read it, called How I Screwed Up My Google Acquisition. And it was about how I perceived an opportunity with the webification of the productivity tools. And this is back when Gmail just came out. So I built a, I thought, you know what, all this stuff's going to go to the web. If I could build one of these tools, be one of the top one or maybe three, I would have a good shot of being acquired by Microsoft, Google, Yahoo, that kind of thing. And I thought PowerPoint would be a sufficiently complicated product that there wouldn't be a whole lot of competition. So I built it over a period of 2 years, and the acquisition almost happened, but it didn't. And anybody's interested in, you know, Google it and read the article itself. But the problem was I built something that I really never used or would have cared to use. So that's kind of a problem. In some sense, I was just like, it was just something I was building to flip. I wanted to build something that could be, that would be bought by Yahoo or Microsoft for $10 or $20 million and be done in three or four years. And I'm not sure that's the best thing to do.
I have a question. Did you essentially bootstrap it? I mean, you said you worked on it for 2 years. It sounds like you bootstrapped it. You didn't go for funding of any kind, right?
No, actually I did. So a guy I knew, a friend of mine who was a very successful entrepreneur and had a lot of capital, had been wanting to invest in another idea that I had. I had been working in the trading space, doing automated trading, algorithmic trading, and what's now termed by most people as high-frequency trading. But right around that time, I was starting to think that the web, I started to notice the web was waking up again. This is like 2004. And I thought, you know, maybe it would be smart to do something on the web. And so he just was like, whatever you want to build, I'll invest in it. He kind of essentially wrote me a blank check. So I went off and I started working on a couple different ideas. The first one was sort of like a web collaboration platform, shared tasks, shared documents, contacts, that kind of a thing. But it seemed like there was a lot of, even then, there was a lot of companies going after that. So I changed direction once or twice, and then I sort of settled on the PowerPoint concept. So I was funded. I mean, I didn't have to do any consulting or anything. I was able to pay myself a reasonable living salary, and that's what I did. That's how it was funded.
Hey, Jason, you should mention what happened to your friend who did follow the first idea, your first path.
So when I first started thinking about the web concept, I asked myself, okay, well, what is the web good for and what does it not do well? And it was collaboration. People are still just emailing stuff around. And I thought, you know, this collaboration stuff should really work much better. And so I started playing around with this collaboration. I think I called it Office G2. I think was the name for it. But when I read an article about Microsoft coming up with a web-based version of SharePoint, and that kind of spooked me, because I remember the lesson that we learned in the 90s was don't compete with Microsoft. Once they're going to move into a space, you might as well just get out or do something else, because they're going to crush you. And I took that a little too literally. So I immediately pivoted. I immediately changed direction. I started going down this sort of wiki route. And not too long after I changed directions, maybe within 6 months or a year, I met a couple of other entrepreneurs who live right in my area in Pasadena, and they started a company called Central Desktop. And they were probably like 2 to 3 months ahead of me. And so when they saw that announcement about Microsoft doing a web-based version of SharePoint, they were too far in, and they're just like, ah, screw it. Let's just keep working on this. I mean, and as it turns out, I don't think Microsoft ever released anything of note, if they ever did it. And Isaac and Arnoff kept pushing on. And now I just had lunch with them yesterday, and I think they're getting close to, I think I have 75, 80 employees or something like that. I mean, they're extremely successful. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what the lesson is there, but it's just like, don't worry about the competition, or don't worry about these big companies, what they're doing, because you can't control these forces. And the markets are usually huge. If the market is big enough for a big company to go into it, then maybe it's big enough to support lots of smaller companies, because they're not everybody's going to choose to go with Microsoft or IBM or Oracle. A lot of people are going to choose other options for different reasons. And in talking to Isaac and Arnoff, even if you went on the web and you looked at all the competitors of Central Desktop, there are a lot of competitors in the space, but it isn't competing. It isn't stopping them from being successful. They competed directly against, I mean, Basecamp was sort of, you know, or at least early on, first few years, was a competitor of theirs. And, you know, 37signals had all this love within tech space, but I mean, I don't think they're doing as well financially as, say, Central Desktop is.
I think Mike and I have talked a lot about this on the podcast. If you go back to episode 5, which is called How to Find a Niche, we talk about, you know, how to find a niche, as you would expect. But beyond that, I've done a lot of writing on it. There's parts of my book that talk about it, and I blog about this probably every few months because it's the most common question I get. I think there are way more people stuck at pre-product phase than there are, you know, actually working on an active idea. People just get stuck in the analysis of it.
I think that both Justin and Jason would agree, though, that just scratching your own itch is probably not the way to go in general. I mean, you really have to analyze the market a little bit and figure out, are people actually willing to pay for this? And if so, you know, what sort of revenue could you reasonably expect from that based on the amount of effort that you're going to have to put forward in order to build it or to have it built for you? And I think that's really the key is finding something, one, that you're kind of interested in, and two, is actually going to make you enough money that it is worth it for you to go in that direction.
Can I just counter that with, there's something to be said for building something and creating some momentum towards moving somewhere. So even if you just start making something, if you've had no momentum and not done anything, and you're stuck in that stage that Rob just described, the kind of pre-product, pre-anything stage, I would say just give it a chance, even for a few months, to just move in a direction, to just get out of your lethargy and actually start making things happen.
I definitely agree with that, because I mean, there's so many people who just sit there and they will not do anything thinking that they're making progress because they're reading blogs or, you know, reading books and learning all these different things, going to meetups. And unless you're actually programming, you're really not making any progress towards developing your product. And it's not to say that you can't pay somebody to do that for you, but the bottom line is that you need to be working towards that, and just learning and consuming information is not going to do it for you.
If you're going to go after something, try and go after something that you can release in a reasonable amount of time, because yeah. I've done this several times where I got after problems that were so hard that it was just going to take years of work. And that makes the whole thing, well, just hard, right? I mean, it increases the risk dramatically that you're not going to have anything ever that you can sell and make money with. So,
yeah,
you know, if you go after something simple, and you whittle it down, even if you spend a month or two working on it, if it's simple enough, you might actually be able to release even something. Something simple, even if it kind of sucks and you only have three people using it, that's way ahead of like something massive that you're like 5% done with.
I'll actually take that one stage further and say, if you start working on it, don't start programming it. Buy a copy of Balsamic Mockups and mock that thing up in a clickable format, so that you can start showing it to people within a week and they can click around it and see what idea you're thinking about and what product you're thinking about. And you can literally iterate. I mean, you could iterate on three or four products in a month and have an idea of whether people really wanted it, whether they were willing to pay for it, just through market research, but at the same time building something that people can get their hands on.
Yeah, my rule of thumb has been, if it's beyond 4 to 6 months of development and marketing work to get it to market, that it's really going to be really hard for you to get there. I see a big drop off with entrepreneurs I work with. Once they go past somewhere between 4 and 6 months, it depends on the person, the momentum just drops way off and they slow down. Very few people who I've seen are able to launch after that point. It is possible, of course, but I'm just talking an odds thing, you know, trying to improve your chance of getting out there.
So what are you saying? The odds of me actually launching AutoShark are minimal at best?
Slim to none.
Well, but here's the thing, and this is a good thing about having a podcast and having a partner who you can regularly speak to about your business. That essentially keeps you in the game, right? That keeps the momentum going.
Yep.
If you guys didn't have that, it'd probably be much harder for you.
And you're an experienced entrepreneur. You've been doing it for 11, 12 years now. You are doing it on the side, quote unquote, but it's not as on the side as a lot of people, where they have 40 or 50 hours a week of a job plus a commute on either end. And you do have some flexibility where you take 1 or 2 weeks completely off and just work on it. There's some extenuating circumstances that all make it, you know, more likely that you're going to get it out the door. And I genuinely think that talking about it, like Justin just said, talking about it on the podcast, period, has made you publicly accountable to this thing. Like when we showed up at Business of Software last week, I don't remember how many people came up and were like, "Hey, Mike, how's AutoShark?" Like guys I'd never met before. I had no idea who they were. And I'm like, man, you're really on the hook. I mean, we're both on the hook, you know? And that's a good thing, I think.
Yeah, I was amazed at that as well. And in fact, I've been getting people lately just tweeting to me and saying, "Hey, how's AutoShark coming? When are you going to launch?"
You know, that's the thing with, you know, the product I've been working on for what, almost 2 years now, is AppIgnite, which is an immensely complicated project. And I think if it wasn't for the podcast, it would be much easier to just sort of bail. But now it's like I've talked so much about it, I would feel really bad about just dropping it. Mm-hmm. But I have to say that the couple of things that I have helping pushing it forward, one of the podcasts, the second one is I have a partner on it, Guyon, and we have sort of a regular thing where we work together like an hour and a half every single workday. So he calls me up or I call him up on Skype and we screen share and work together. And, you know, I would recommend doing something like that. if you can, if there's somebody it's convenient to work with that you trust, that maybe have complementary skill sets or whatever, at least have a very shared vision, just having someone else that you can do something with can really get you going. Because a lot of times what happens is, you know, work or life or whatever just sort of starts getting in your way, and it just starts pushing the startup idea further out of your daily habit, and then to the point where you just lose all momentum. But if someone's calling you up and say, hey, are we going to work on this tomorrow? Are we going to work on this? Or what's going on? It just keeps you going.
I think that actually segues really nice into the second topic, which was the logistics of working on a product, when, where, how much time, et cetera. And yeah, I think that what you just talked about is kind of this accountability, this daily accountability that forces you to do it and not work it out of your routine. Anyone else do that? I don't have a daily accountability, but I have a biweekly. Every 2 weeks, I meet with a mastermind group here in Fresno, and I basically ask them to take me to task if I'm not doing the stuff that I should be.
You know, like I said, with AppIgnite, I do have a daily schedule that I work with Guy on, and it's usually, you know, right about 1:30 to 3 p.m. every day, my time, which is kind of middle of my day. And then I also will work on the weekends on it. But lately, like the project that Justin and I have been working on together called AnyFoo, that is less of a daily sort of shared, you know, work session. It's more like we're working on our different pieces, and then we're just communicating, we're talking about it on the podcast or email or whatever. I think if you can get a regular work schedule on something, I think it's easier. I think it's easier to keep momentum, because I don't think that's talked about as enough as the importance of that it plays in just realizing a long-term goal. If you do something every day, it goes so much towards pushing you through the hard spots, you know, because you just sometimes you reach a hard point, but if you just like get on it every day, eventually you're going to bust through it. But if you work on it, you reach a hard part, and then you kind of like don't do anything on it for a week, it's so easy to kind of forget about it and be like, I don't really want to work on it. And then it just kind of falls out of your mind space.
I have this concept of banking enthusiasm. You know how like when you gamble and you can bank your savings? So once they're banked, they're not on the table anymore. I sort of feel like that same thing applies to enthusiasm. So when I feel very enthusiastic to work on Plugio, I may be working on a client's work. I'm fortunate enough that I'm a consultant, so I can choose what I work on. When I get the enthusiasm, I'm like, okay, I'm going to bank this right now. And I switch over to Plugio and work in that enthusiastic mode, because I feel that it just makes it easier to get, you know, get good work done.
Huh, that's kind of a cool idea. I have found myself, since I have a bunch of different projects I'm working on all the time, I've done the same thing, but I've never thought about it in that respect.
I don't know. I think I'm kind of approach it with sort of a hybrid mindset. I had a hard deadline for my master's thesis at one point where, you know, you've only got so long to finish it. And I had, you know, you've got 7 years to finish it, at least here in the U.S. And I was bearing down on that 7 year mark, and I knew I had to get it done. And it was one of those things where I didn't want to do it. I pushed it off for so long. And then I'm like, okay, well, I've already dumped a ton of money at this college for this degree. I better get it. So I just buckled down, and I wrote a little bit every day, and I got a couple of books on kind of guiding you through the process of writing. And the consistent theme that I found was do a little bit every day, even if it's not a lot. And looking at a blank page when you've got a couple hundred pages to write is really intimidating. But if you just concentrate on writing like one sentence, the next sentence is a lot easier than the first, and you kind of get on a roll. And, you know, just like Justin said, you kind of bank that enthusiasm. And as you start working on it, it really can build on its own. It helps you get motivated, and it helps you get through to the points that get to where you need to be.
You know, I just commented that I have a theory about the 4 to 6 month time frame and how it drops off dramatically after that. And so if you look at it on a kind of the logistics of working on it, and you think someone's probably got to put in 10 hours a week at least during that time to get it, and obviously more is better. So if we say 10 to 15 hours a week is kind of the what's going to be required to get something out the door in 4 to 6 months, then you're looking at 4 months at 10 hours would be like 100 and gosh, I guess it's around 120 hours total, which seems pretty thin to me. And then 15 hours a week, 6 months, the top end would be, that'd be about 300, almost 350. So somewhere between 120, it's a pretty wide range, but 120 to 350 hours to get the 1.0 out the door. And that include, that's not just coding, right? That's actually QA, and it's getting the marketing website done, and it's getting marketing going. It's getting a sales page up, a landing page, collecting emails, and then doing a launch and all that stuff. What do you guys think about that, about trying to limit yourself to something like that to get a 1.0 out the door? Is that realistic?
I'm just thinking that perhaps you're almost defining a new kind of rule. You know, that rule 10,000 hours to get to become an expert at something. Maybe there's a rule for how many hours you need to launch something.
Right.
Yeah, you could break it down into like, okay, well, 20 hours for this, 50 yep. hours for that, you know.
If you think about it in terms of 40-hour weeks, though, I mean, that's 9 weeks. I mean, 360 hours is about 9 weeks. And right. if,
that's 2 months of work.
Oh, yeah. And if you're putting in that much time and effort on something, if you have your idea and you know what you're going to do, 9 weeks seems like it's a lot of time to put something together that is at least sellable.
Right.
I mean, unless it's extremely complicated, it seems like you could do it.
I guess the hard part is knowing, you got to know that you're building the right thing, right? So you'd almost have to factor in like customer development during that time or do it beforehand and really have a good idea of what you're building when you start that.
Well, I think you do it beforehand because I don't think you consider it as part of the actual development time because you have to do all this upfront work to decide what it is that you're going to build and how you're going to present it, whether there's competition, whether people are going to pay for it. And that's more or less research time. It's not even development time. It's the R part of the R&D.
Yeah, I had a spreadsheet that kind of listed all this stuff out, like has all the tasks and has the hour estimates, and that's actually in the academy. I should dig that out. I haven't looked at it in probably a year, and I think I did have the estimate. It was 400 to 600 hours at the time, but I'd be interested to see now with kind of just the new paradigm of getting launches out quicker if that could be edited down, because I think this is helpful for people, right? If you've never tried to build a product on the side, I get that question a lot. It's like, well, how long is this going to take? How long should it take? And it's like telling someone you should plan on 4 to 6 months, 200 to 400 hours, or 400 to 600, whatever it is actually as kind of weird as that sounds to us to talk about. I think that's like a decent guide, a decent general rule. You can certainly fall outside of that. Obviously, AutoShark is, AppIgnite is, Plugio. Now, did you launch Plugio, which was TweetMiner at the time, did you launch it in less time than that?
I launched it in 3 months, I think. Okay. I went from the original idea that we spoke about it, because we actually, I think we thought about it on the podcast, and I think within 3 months I had a beta version.
I thought it was quicker than that.
Was it? Yeah, it could have been.
You sent me an email, you're like, I have an idea, I'm going to make some money. I was like, what are you talking about? You know, and he was like, yeah, it's just going to do this thing. And you're like, I have an idea to make some quick cash. That was kind of how I put it.
Oh, yeah. It's really been quick cash. I can tell you that. Jesus.
Well, it's an interesting question because, you know, a lot of people would kill to have a product that brings in $3,000 a month. Would you say it's worth it, what you've done?
Okay. Because I spoke at your guys' conference,
right.
MicroConf, and part of my presentation was that I expected, just like Jason said, I expected to make a boatload of cash, and I launched this thing and I kind of went to like $600 a month. And because of my lack of experience as an entrepreneur, I didn't really understand how much time needed to be devoted to marketing from that point forward. So I kind of gave up on it and just left it for 9 months. And it just kept on at this rate of the 500. And then people on the show got pretty angry with me. Just like, I kept on talking about trying to start new businesses and they were like, why? You've got this one that's making money. All you need to do is market it. So then I went back into the marketing of it, and it kind of took another, I guess, year to take it to 3,000, maybe 3,100 revenue per month. So I was never expecting that. If I'd have known that when I was starting, I never would have done it, because it's like you have to put this much work in. I mean, it's almost like diminishing returns. It's like to reach the speed of light, you know, you need to use more and more explosives to get there. And that's what I feel like it's been like for me with Plugio. Partially why I would recommend working in a different space to social media for anyone.
Yeah, so let me jump in here a couple. I think Justin launched, I think he had a beta version in like 6 weeks. I don't think it was 3 months. I think he maybe had in beta for a month, but you got it done pretty fast.
Yeah,
I mean,
true.
Justin, once Justin gets on something, like he can't think about anything else and he'll just code night and day. And I think that's kind of what you did for like a month or 6 weeks. And then you got it up and it was making more than 500. I mean, I think it pretty quickly got up to like $800, it was like 850 or something. And then it kind of sat there. So without a whole lot of work, you got to that 800. It was just getting it past that. That was hard, right?
Well, yeah, because what I had was, at the time, I had the ability for people to pay a year in advance in the sign-up form. And I kind of felt, once again, because of naivety, I sort of felt like I was cheating myself by doing that. So originally, a few people were signing up, and they were basically paying $100 up front. And so that was really skewing the figures. So 1 month I was getting 600, the next month I was getting 300, the next month I was getting 1,000. So I didn't really understand what on earth was going on. So I decided to just remove the ability to pay the year in advance, which I probably should have kept. But anyway, that's the way that I stuck at it. and I just only included monthly revenue from that point forward.
But those are all marketing problems. Those aren't really the problems associated with building it. I mean, the thing that comes to mind for me is the fact that when you look at like Y Combinator, for example, you've got these this small group of people who are stuffed in a room eating ramen noodles for like 2.5 months. And that's all they do is they, you know, work on whatever their idea is. Now, granted, they get more than their 40 hours a weekend and they've got a small team of people, but they put these things together in like 6 or 8 weeks because they've got demos that they've got to do before their 12 weeks is up.
Right. I think they have weekly, they definitely have weekly meetings where they all meet and they have training and they hear a speaker and they are doing customer development, or some of them are at least, so that it's not just sitting in a basement coding.
They also have a team of people. So the differentiating factor is, let's say they've got 2 or 3 people and yep. they're working on it. Each of them's putting in 40 hours a week. Say one person's doing the customer development. You've got 2 other people who are doing the coding. What's it take to crank out a beta of something with 2 people working 40 to 80 hours a week on it? It's like 5-6 weeks. I mean, right. It depends on how complicated it is. But once they start getting funding, I mean, they can add people, they can start dealing with problems of scale and things like that. And most of those are dealing with much larger types of applications than I think that we're talking about.
Okay, so basically, I'm earning $3,000 a month right now because 2 years ago, I decided to scratch my own itch. And then I had the momentum of a partner talking to me about it on a podcast and fans bugging me about it on the podcast for 2 years. And that's the reason why it's there at this stage.
But you also took a year off and didn't do anything.
Yeah.
And the other thing is, I think sometimes it's dangerous to extrapolate too much and like say, well, it's going to be this hard for everyone, because, you know, it might be that Justin is swimming upstream with Plugio in the sense that it's just a hard market to break into or to earn a revenue stream from. I mean, you might be able to build something 6 to 8 weeks and you put in some marketing effort and it just kind of catches a little wind. I mean, you think of things like GitHub. I mean, it's just the right problem at the right time, you know?
Yeah, but I think that the issue that we're trying to talk about is really how to launch something, not necessarily how to deal with it after the launch. I mean, there's obviously the okay. post-launch aspects of it, but I think that getting to launch is the thing that a lot of people struggle with. I mean, there are so many people, so many developers out there who have half-written applications sitting on their hard drive that are just wasting space because they just
didn't I'm included in that group. I have bunch of apps from like 5, 6, 7 years ago. Yeah, all kinds of different ideas. I came across them the other day. I was like, crap, this is embarrassing. I should take a screenshot and
it
post this publicly so people can mock me.
It is embarrassing. But you know what? I think we all do it, though. There's tons of things that we start and we're just like, nah, this isn't going to work. And it's either because you got bored with it or you didn't do the customer development or somebody else came out with a product that you think would kill it. There's all these reasons. But the fundamental thing I think we're talking about here is just how long does it take to actually get to launch from the time that you decide to do it to the time that you can get that minimum viable product out the door that somebody is going to actually pay money for.
Yeah. The reason I was bringing that up, that thing about Justin, about how hard it is, it's just that, and the reason I think it's important is that when you make things sound harder than they are, then it can be discouraging. Like, oh, he worked so hard and he's just getting to 3,000. It's like, well, he worked hard and he didn't, you know? I mean, and it might have just been the idea. So I often see that people succeed. They're like, don't do this. It's super hard. And oh, wow, wow. I'm like, I don't know if it's that hard. And I don't know if it's going to take that much time. I mean, sometimes if you have a better idea than other ideas, or an idea that's just sort of the moment people are more interested in, or it's going to be more viral, or people are more willing to pay for, don't worry about it being so hard. Back to the point that you're bringing up, Mike, is just get something up quickly, because there's nothing that's going to give you more momentum quicker than having somebody write you a, you know, actually make a payment. So if you can get something up after 2 or 3 months, get something quick, and you, even if you get like $50 in for a month or $30, like, you know, it's actually can feel pretty good. And then that'll get you to the next point where you're making $150 a month and then $300, and then you're off to the races. So the sooner that you can get it up and get someone paying you, the better.
Well, what I think has been the most important thing that's happened in the last 2 years with Plugio was very, very close to the launch time. So it really is about the early stage of the development of your business. And this doesn't necessarily apply to every kind of business, but I think that for a business where people are using your product, your SaaS product, a lot, this is very important. And that is getting to a stage where you have between 3 and 5 people who are like early adopters. And it just takes like 3 people who just really love the promise and the hope of what you're doing. And they are emailing with you every day and basically you have this iterative cycle where you build the features that they request, and you're just working with just that tiny core group of people building the seed, growing it. That has been the most important thing, I think, for Plugio.
That's cool. It sounds like customer development, except it's not in person. You're basically getting your control group together and just getting all the feedback from them.
Well, because they're passionate about it. They're trying to build this thing. They've got problems they want to get solved. And the chances are that if it's going to work for these three or five people and you're solving problems for that tiny little group, and they're thinking, oh, wow, I've got this person who's building me custom software to solve my problems, then it's going to help you because it's going to work for a lot more people if it can work for even a handful of people.
Right.
And I got something to add to that, actually. So you can actually get to that sooner. So when you have a product, great, you get those early adopters and you start a conversation with them. But if you talk about your idea as you're working on it, and I don't care if you're talking about it on Twitter or in your blog or Facebook or Google Plus or whatever, then you can start getting some feedback from people, because if you don't even have to ask for it outright. When you talk about something that's of interest to other people, they're going to respond and they're going to say, hey, that sounds kind of cool. And people don't like to talk about their ideas because they're so worried that someone's going to steal it. But no one's going to steal your stupid idea, because at this stage, it's just an idea, and it hasn't been proven that it's going to make any money. And if it's already been proven, but if you're going after a space where there's already people doing it, then there's nothing to steal, right? If people are going to steal something, they're probably going to try and steal an idea, or rather, they're going to compete with an idea that's already demonstrated that it's making money. Your idea hasn't demonstrated anything. So don't worry about people stealing your idea. Start talking about it, and then you can feed off the enthusiasm that you get back from people saying, hey, I can't wait till that sounds really cool. Let me know when it's available, that kind of stuff. But on the other side, if it's crickets, like if you talk about it in your blog and nobody seems to care about it, then that might be an indication they might be working on the wrong thing.
Right. I think another piece to that is that if you have an idea that's so easy to steal that someone mm-hmm. can go out and build it and beat you to market, then when you launch, you're going to launch and they're going to build it in 2 months. And they're going to eat your lunch anyways, right? It's not really about the technology. It's about if they can steal your idea and outmarket you, then they're going to outmarket you now or in 6 months. Would you rather build it or not?
There's been a lot of times when people have said, oh, I don't want to tell you my idea. I don't want to tell you my idea. And then because it's like, you know, you need to sign some kind of NDA or whatever. And then they end up telling me that their idea. And I just don't understand it. It's like, yeah. What the hell are you talking about? You know, like most of the time, even when you have an idea, it's probably not even well formed enough that people actually get it.
Well, yeah, I remember explaining Audit Shark to you at MicroConf, and it took a while before you understood what it actually was and what it did.
Takes
well,
a while
because you missed out like the key piece of information about Audit Shark that I think that, and I still haven't heard you say it, which is that you actually have actual software that gets installed on each person's machine, and that's the kind of key component that makes it just work really easy for them. They just install this software, and then they don't need to do anything else from that point forward. Just click a button, the software takes care of everything else.
It's actually the opposite. They install the software on one machine, and they don't have to install it on all the others, but they still get the information from them.
Right, so the long and the short of it is they don't have to do anything. They just it just works from that point forward. And it's
right.
Like it collects all of their information and saves them an awful lot of hassle and boredom.
Yep.
But, you know, in terms of stealing idea, you know, a good example is the project that Justin and I are working on. We talked about the idea that we're working on now, AnyFoo, a year and a half ago. And we not only did we talk about the idea that we thought it could work, we were saying somebody should go do this because we were working on our own. I was working on AppIgnite. He's working on Plugio. And a year goes by and nobody's doing it, right?
But not only that, but we're talking to an audience of between 1,000 and 1,500 entrepreneurs.
It's like if anyone's going to take it, it'd be them, right?
Right.
Well, but the thing is, those people are also your audience. And I think that if they were to do that and if they were to try and take it, quote unquote, from underneath you, there's a certain amount of loyalty that your listeners are going to have. And they're not going to want to do that to you. Now,
No. We actually were telling them that somebody should do this idea. We're not going to do it. Somebody do this.
We wanted it to exist.
Yeah.
So if people are curious, if you're listening and you don't know what AnyFoo is, you can go to it's anyfu.com.
I want to know. Is that intentional? Yeah.
No. It's AnyFoo, you know, Kung Fu. So foo is one interpretation is it's an expertise. So basically anyexpertise.com, except it's anyfoo.com.
Right. So it's just-in-time expertise. It's kind of like a high-level, hourly Elance or Odesk. So on their landing page, they say if Elance and Odesk are the 99-cent stores, AnyFu is going to be like a Tiffany and Company. So it's high-level experts, people who have published, are speakers, who are just super knowledgeable. And as far as I know, you guys are going to limit the number of folks who can be in any given expertise. So if you have a Ruby on Rails or a Node.js or a Backbone or whatever, it's like the best of the
best. It's people like you, Rob, but not Mike. He was so offended.
We outlined what we thought was a good idea, why it would work, why we'd pay for it, why we had paid people for something similar on our own. And just by, like, we needed experts. We went and hunted them down on the web, went through all the problem of trying to communicate them from email and hire them and all that kind of stuff. But even though we outlined the business case and how the technology would work, it was still like, okay, so that might work, right? There's still no proof that would be a business. And so that's why nobody would steal it, right? You can go on the web and you could look at any number of these little startups that have popped out of Y Combinator or the other incubators and go, hi, you know, they're making money. That's a good idea. I'll go compete with them.
The problem with AnyFu, I think, though, is that whoever puts it together is left with this problem where you have to bring two sides together, and without one, the other one is kind of useless.
Right. It's the marketplace problem, right, which is always...
Yeah, and something else is, and I just add to this discussion here, is that when we first spoke about this idea, this just goes to show you, essentially, it's about execution rather than the idea. Because I don't think that AnyFu would be as successful as I think it's going to be if we hadn't spent a year thinking about it, talking about it, because it is not... By the time we've worked it all out, and basically the product that we're creating, I can pretty much guarantee you it is not put together in the way that you expect it to be put together. It's completely different to what I had imagined it.
But, you know, something that I think listeners should take away from this is every time I've seen you guys, whether it's been one-on-one or at MicroConf, you guys are talking about the idea, you're asking people questions, and you're listening to the feedback. Both of you guys, last time I was down in LA, we met for a couple hours each, and you guys had really pointed questions, very specific, and were genuinely interested. You weren't just talking about it to blah, 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 here's an idea. It was like, we're working on this part, what do you think? Do you think people will use this? Would you use it? How are we going to get around this problem? And it was like, you really have spent a lot of upfront time developing this idea and being very open about it and public, and as a result, you have maybe the best opinions from the 50 people you've talked about, whether it's me or the group of people you had a whole dinner table at MicroConf, and you guys were all chatting about it, and they were all giving you feedback, and I know you changed the idea because of these things.
That was like a two-hour, yeah. That was a two-hour brainstorming session with, I don't know, 8 to 10 successful tech entrepreneurs. These are all people who would be potential clients and also potential experts. And we went through, and you sat down, Rob, for a while, and we went through a number of like business models of how to make it work. And we iterated through about 3 or 4 different versions of it until we hit on what was going to work. Because every time someone say, well, do you charge an expert to be on the site? And we're like, no, that's not going to make sense for this, and this reason that a couple people would throw out. And then we'd go with another version and say, that's not going to scale for this. I mean, like, we iterated so fast because it wasn't just Justin and I talking. It was a group of 10 people. For like 2 hours.
Yeah, and that's invaluable, right? If you're sitting in your basement, or even the two of you talking on the podcast, the idea would never have evolved that quickly, or maybe never would have evolved to that point at all without getting the feedback.
Right, right. So. I agree. Absolutely.
So definitely talk about your ideas.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the takeaway, right? Figure out a list of questions. Actually, at BOS last week, I had a list of questions. And you know who's good at this is Harry Hollander and Ted Pitts. They are founders of Moreaware Software. Every time I go to a conference with them, they come and they always at the beginning, they say, yeah, so I have these two questions I'm asking everyone. We're trying to figure out, you know, this year it was like they're trying to hire someone and I forget what the other one was, but that was their goal, was to get that question, quote unquote, answered, you know, by as many people as possible. And I think that's a really kind of a cool way to do it.
You know what Ted's question for me was why haven't you launched Audit Shark yet?
Yeah, I know.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up Ted and Harry because they were at that table with us.
Yep.
And I think Ted had a couple very important points in that conversation. And, you know, they've built a successful business themselves. So they had some great advice for us. I mean, then both of them were saying, listen, whatever, you know, revenue model you have, you got to make sure it scales with the usage. Because the first things we're throwing out just weren't going to scale. You know,
right. It was like flat fees, right?
Flat fees. He's like, that's not quirky. You're going to charge that and you're going to be very sad. I'm saying that. That's the phrase is you're going to be sad.
You're going to make your experts a lot of money and you will get $10 or whatever.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We have three more points that Mike had planned that we answer, but frankly, we'll have to have you guys back on. That's the.
I'd love to do it.
I think that's the takeaway here is that we all have a lot to say and we have, you know, a lot of experience and stuff. So hopefully folks enjoy the episode and we can either finish up this topic at some time in the future or just choose another potentially random one and go at it.
Absolutely.
I had a lot of fun. This was cool.
Yeah, same here. It was great. Thanks for inviting us on.
You're welcome.
Really, really fun to be on the show.
And if you're a listener of this podcast and you haven't checked out TechZing, you definitely should. The URL is techzinglive.com. And of course, if you go on iTunes and search for TechZing, you can find both of these guys. And then guys, I know you both have logs. You also both have products. So each throw out one website, one URL where someone, you know, could get in touch with you or where you'd prefer that they go and check stuff out about you.
JustinVincent.com. That's my blog.
Yeah, and for me, it would be codusoperandi.com.
Interestingly enough, if you also search for Startups for the Rest of Us in iTunes, their podcast comes up. So with that, if you have a question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. Full transcript of this podcast will be available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.